The following program is intended for an audience that is blind or print impaired. I'm Kurt Benrud. Welcome to Science Fiction Shorts, brought to you by a team of volunteer readers. Our program will be available in podcast after the initial broadcast.
This is Faith Crutch, reading Luna City at Night by Carl L. Kura. Every night before I hit the bars, I push the mattress off my bed and pick out one of the expensive watches. In my house, under the mattress is the safest hiding spot. I select a watch like I do every Friday night and put it on. Real leather wallets keep the watches company. I choose one of those and shove money inside. Without the mattress, my bed looks like a snake lover's garden. Silvery serpentine watches crawl over brown rock-like wallets. I replace the mattress. Every time I head out, I think, Luna City is beautiful at night. It's the same every night, but it's beautiful. Daytime is a recurring nightmare filled with unceasing sameness. I get up at the same time each day and take my shower at the exact same time because the water supply is tightly controlled. I wait for a crowded floater to stop in front of my dome and for the driver to throw open the dome's latch. I get on the floater and stand between the same sweaty people, and I never get a seat, and I get off at the dome stop linked up to my work complex. The floater keeps going, bumping along on a jet of pushed air, a giant farting machine. As precise as clockwork, the floater comes around at the same time each day and farts along at the same speed, traveling every day along the same dome-potted path. At work, every day is the exact same. I work with the same people and take my breaks in the same cafeteria. I come into work every day at the same time, and I eat lunch at the same time, and the boss yells every day at the same time. But nighttime is a different story. Nighttime, the dome lights are dimmed and pretty girls go out to the bars. They all wear tight pants and yellow eyeshadow and dark green lipstick. The same, but beautiful. When I leave my apartment at night, I never take the floater. I walk in the underground tunnels connecting the domes. I walk in the tunnels taking my time and looking at the people that pass by. And when I feel like I've walked enough, I take the nearest elevator into whichever dome I've reached. I'm not worried about finding my way around. The domes all have the same design, and each has a bar or two or three. This one has three. The streets are narrow. There are no cars on the moon, and floaters travel the undeveloped spaces between domes. Everyone walks everywhere inside a dome, and everyone is walking everywhere now. The dome is packed, people pouring through the narrow streets like angry water racing down the twists and turns of a badly designed river. Each building, dome top like the larger dome above it, announces its existence with an arching sign that follows the curve of its roof. At night, those buildings still open for business, restaurants and bars and movie theaters mostly, turn on their neon to outline the letters of their signs in bright green or pink or orange. I go into the nearest bar. It's packed, like the streets. The bars all play the same music, and they play it over and over again. DJs don't decide what to play, but when to play it and how often. The songs themselves are all the same, and it's sometimes hard to know when one song has finished and another has begun. I see a girl, then walk up to her and offer to buy her a drink. She says yes. I pull out my wallet, but can't tell if her gaze drifts over the money inside. As I'm paying the waiter, I think I see her gaze drift over my silver watch. Later, she says yes. She will come home with me. We walk in the tunnels, but don't talk at all. I unlock my door to let her in, like I've done for 100 girls on 100 different nights. We are inside my room, and I leave the lights off, like every other time. I come up behind her, wrapping my arms around her waist. I begin to undress her. She turns around, allowing her clothes to fall to the floor. She begins to undress me. I bend my head. We kiss. We are in bed. We're making love. It is the same, but it is beautiful, like Luna City at night. I turn over and pretend to sleep. I am content, although I know what will happen, what has happened over 100 times before. The girl I brought home will pretend to sleep too. A short while later, she will get up, Being very quiet, she will slip my watch off the nightstand, then ruffle through my clothes looking for my wallet. If I'm still awake, I'll hear the door open. Then I'll hear her close. I sleep. In the morning, I stretch my arms but bump against something hard. "Ow," she says, rubbing her head. "You're still here," I say. Without meaning to, my gaze drifts over to the nightstand. My watch is there, my clothes undisturbed. She gives me a quizzical look. "Did you expect me to leave in the middle of the night?" "Luna City is beautiful at night," I blurt out, not sure what I'm saying. She rises from the bed and goes to the window, pulls back the curtain to let the light in. I think it's gorgeous in daytime. I rise and come up behind her, wrapping my arms around her again, the same as the night before, but somehow entirely different. And I look out over my little dome, bathed in a dawnish light, and at the domes I can see past my own, glowing with their own dawnish light.
This is Scott Youngkin reading A Change of Heart by Rachel Halpern. Clara got her first clue in preschool just before nap time one day as Miss Weston read aloud from a massive, gleaming book of fairy tales. Clara knew most of them already, though the versions were different, and this Snow White was stabbed with a poison comb before she ever touched an apple. Others, though, were entirely new to her, stories of huts with chicken legs and beautiful forest women with hollow backs. And then there was the giant who hid his heart so he could live forever. The tale was all about the prince, about his perilous quest to find and destroy the heart. But Clara couldn't help feeling that it was bad enough to kill a person. Anyone knew that was murder, and much worse after they'd gone to all that trouble. She didn't cry, because even at 4 she never cried, couldn't remember ever caring enough to cry. But she felt a strange solemnity come over her, at the words like a shadow passing overhead. She could imagine the giant staring with awful, pitiful eyes as his heart was crushed, and she shuddered. When Clara was 13, her parents sat her down in the living room and said they had to have a talk. They said A, but Clara had a pretty good idea they meant the, and she tried to spare them the embarrassment by cutting them off at the pass. "I pretty much get the birds and bees thing," she told them, hoping that would be the end of it, but her parents just looked more uncomfortable, not relieved. Clara's mother pushed dark curls neatly off her face onto a clasp, the way she did when she was preparing for a confrontation, and said, "Darling, it's about your heart." For a moment she thought they were trying a different angle on the birds and bees conversation, a sort of "when a man loves a woman" approach. But they looked so serious that it hit her, suddenly, that they meant her literal heart, her real heart, the one that never seemed to pound during gym class, even when they had to run the mile, the one Dr. Annan never bothered listening to with her stethoscope, and always said was doing just fine. Clara had been sick when she was very small, sick enough that she remembered it hazily, even though she remembered only flickers of that age. Learning to walk was one, the brief jolt of pride as she staggered across a room. A few flashes of places she'd been before, she really started thinking for herself. Nothing more. But a lot of those flashes had bright white light and pale walls and cold, dry sheets of paper on doctors' tables. She thought there might have been some surgeries even, but it was hard to place anything from before she was 3 or 4. "What's wrong with me?" she asked, but she didn't feel the kind of fear they described in books, that people showed in movies, like she ought to feel now that she was probably dying. "There's nothing wrong with you," her father said, with enough force that Clara supposed it must mean the exact opposite. "So what is it, then?" she asked, trying not to sound like she didn't believe him. "There was a procedure," he said, and then looked at her mother for guidance. "Darling," her mother said again, and Clara had never quite understood pet names. Her mother wielded "darling" like it could somehow soften whatever she said next, but Clara just found the extra syllables wearing, more time spent waiting for the answer. "You were very sick when you were little," her mother said. "No one knew what was wrong with you, but you got sicker every day. We thought you might die. The doctor said there was nothing else they could do, that you had less than a week left.
They were sorry. They were sorry. Sorry they were so useless, I suppose. Pathetic. Then we met Dr. Annan, her father said quietly. She said there was a procedure that no ordinary doctor would imagine, something theoretical, something implausible. Implausible was the word her father used for magic, Clara had learned, for the way that sometimes you met someone who could tell your fortune in seashells off the beach, stop a storm with the breaking of a chicken bone. Mostly you saw this stuff on TV, and no one quite knew how it worked yet. So though there were people who could heal, if they tried, with burned coriander, who sang broken ships out of the sea, they were few and far between, and the charlatans far more common. Her parents did not hold with it, hesitated to believe in magic, mostly, not without good evidence. They did not even seem able to say the word. Clara could hardly believe they would listen to anyone, even a doctor, who said magic would save their child. It was the strangest procedure, her mother said. She used a scalpel, but also rose petals, and a cedar box lined with silk, and I can't remember what else. Oil-based paint, her father said. I had to run to the art shop to buy some. Yellow, I think, and violet. We weren't allowed in the operating room for most of it, her mother said, and she told us it never would have worked if you hadn't been so young, still malleable. It was an experimental procedure anyway, but at the end of it, you were fine, and she gave us the box. Here her mother trailed off, and Clara saw something that might have been disgust in her mother's face. What was in the box? Clara asked, and it felt like a call-and-response story, like she had to ask that question just then, in just her usual disinterested tone, like a lever she could press to make her parents speak the truth. Her father lifted a box from the floor beside him and passed it to her. It was roughly cube-shaped, made of smooth, dark wood, and it felt heavier than it had any right to in her hand. She opened it with only a slight hesitation because the truth was better than not knowing, because she had never understood how fear could be strong enough to stop anyone doing anything. The box was indeed lined with silk, pale gray, and spattered with flecks of paint, yellow and violet and pale blue, a drip of the garish purple down the side, as if by accident. At the center was, it took her a moment to realize it was a heart, not quite the shape she would draw on a page, and not quite the shape in her anatomy textbook, but somehow neither and both at once, and just opening the box sent a wave of heat over her face, her heart emanating warmth in slow pulses. There wasn't a smell exactly, more a texture to the air rising from it, that felt softer and smoother than the air in the room. It wasn't very big, but bigger than a baby's heart for sure. It must have been growing with her. "This is mine?" she asked, even though she knew the answer, because she could not quite imagine letting even someone as reliable and serene as Dr. Annan, even someone terrifically implausible, cut the heart out of a child in hopes of saving it. It was like the giant's heart, she thought. She could imagine it being crushed slowly in front of her, felt the same quiet horror she had felt in hearing the tale. She could not hide her heart in an egg, in a duck locked away on an island, however much she might like to, and it was horrifying to have it both beating and not beating in her hand, waves of warmth coming off it against her skin, hideously vulnerable and keeping her safe. "How do I put it back in?" she asked, and looked up to see her parents' faces stiffen with horror. "You can't," her mother said, as though the thought were terrible, even obscene. "You don't understand. You were dying. You had days, maybe hours, and no one knew how to stop it." "That's all that's keeping you alive, as far as we know." "Besides," her father said, and she thought he might be trying feebly to sound jovial, "we're pretty sure that makes you immortal. Don't you want to live forever?" When Clara was 15, her best friend Nicole was almost killed in a hit-and-run. Clara went to visit her in the hospital carrying flowers, because that was how it was done, though she couldn't quite see why. since the flowers wouldn't do much for Nicole when she was in a coma. Nicole's favorite color was orange. Clara had always said hers was as well, because people noticed in grade school if you didn't have favorites of everything. So Clara brought tiger lilies and carried them in a neat green-wrapped bouquet. The nurses put them in a vase and left her alone with Nicole comatose in the bed, their faces terribly sympathetic, and Clara stood wondering what she was supposed to do now. "Sorry about the accident" seemed appropriate, so she said it, and then, a bit less confidently, "Get well soon." That pretty much exhausted the set of things she knew to say to someone who was hurt, let alone someone who couldn't even hear her, so she stood fidgeting for a bit, and then went to look out the window at the sunlit parking lot and wondered how much longer she was supposed to stand there. There was a tapping at the door, and she turned to see the nurse just stepping in, murmuring something about being sorry to disturb her, and Clara said hastily, "No, it's all right. You can take care of her much better than I can," and was relieved when this earned her an approving smile instead of a frown. "Well, aren't you grown up?" the nurse said, and Clara smiled uncertainly back, because she wasn't sure if she was allowed to smile with Nicole in the bed next to her. Her parents would have told her to go with what she felt. They always wanted her to express her emotions, but she never really felt like smiling, any more than she felt like crying. At any rate, the nurse kept smiling as she left the room, so Clara decided she must have done well enough. Out in the waiting room, her parents looked up in surprise. "Done already?" her mother said, and her father hushed her quietly. Clara thought perhaps he assumed she was scared of hospitals. After they told her about her heart, they were still walking on eggshells about that 2 years after they told her, 14 years after it happened. Clara supposed parents were like that. "The nurse came in," she said, and that was an appropriate response because her mother's slight frown lightened, and they were able to leave the chemical-smelling hospital and return home. Clara went to her room to read because she was probably supposed to be fretting and had almost forgotten about Nicole by the time her parents called her for dinner, caught up in reading The Great Gatsby for school and trying to understand any of the characters' motivations. When Nicole got better, Clara walked into her house with a plate of brownies she and her mother had baked together. When she reached the house, Nicole's father looked haggard, but pleased to see his daughter's friend, and he waved her up to Nicole's room. Nicole wasn't allowed to get up yet, but she brightened when she saw Clara, and even more when she saw the plate Clara was carrying. "You brought me brownies," Nicole said, beaming at her. "You are now officially my best friend for life." Clara smiled a little uncertainly, setting the trays on one of the bedside tables. "I thought we were already best friends for life." Nicole said, "Clearly I just never understood how much you deserved my admiration until this moment." In spite of what she'd said, she didn't actually reach to take one, and after a second Clara realized she had set the plate to Nicole's right, since she was right-handed, but that arm was currently in a cast. She picked the tray back up and moved it to the other side of the bed as quickly as she could, before Nicole could protest, and Nicole looked at her in a different way, pleased and grateful, and maybe a little embarrassed, Clara thought, guessing people's feelings were hard, but she'd known Nicole long enough to recognize most of the signs. "Thanks," Nicole said, her voice going suddenly quiet, and Clara nodded because she didn't know what else to say. "It's just..." Nicole shook her head sharply, as if that might clear the choking Clara could hear in her voice. "I really thought I was going to die, you know. It was... they say your life flashes before your eyes, but I didn't have time for that. I was too scared to think about it. It was just..." She wiped impatiently at her eyes with her left hand. "And I can't even leave the house for 2 more weeks. And I have this cast on and it hurts. And I know I should be grateful that I survived, but I really just want my life back." Clara could just about recognize fear and pain in Nicole's face, hear it in her voice, but it was literally unimaginable. She reached out to set her hand on Nicole's arm, the good one, as carefully as she could, and got a shaky smile in return. "And here I'm spoiling your visit entirely." Nicole took her briskly, wiping her eyes again. "After you brought me brownies and everything." "It's all right," Clara said. "You really should have a brownie, though. My mom helped me make them, so they're actually good." Nicole laughed a little weakly and took a brownie, and Clara settled in next to her to talk about what she'd been missing at school. By the next time she visited, the story of the accident had morphed from that raw fear into something theatrical, vivid, more dramatic than painful. If she hadn't seen Nicole that first day, she would never have believed it, and she marveled at the kind of emotion nearly dying seems to produce. Perhaps she ought to try it sometime. But she was busy, and anyway, she doubted it would work, knowing that probably nothing could kill her. Nicole was always excited anyway, a swirl of test-taking anxiety and laughing energy. Perhaps that kind of fear was something only Nicole would feel so remarkably. When Clara was 17, Dr. Annan asked about her personal life at her yearly checkup. It was the first time Clara had not felt like a lab rat, only of interest as proof of Dr. Annan's implausible technique. She answered hesitantly as Dr. Annan took her blood pressure and poked things into Clara's ears, and when the normal exam was over, Dr. Annan asked her to wait. "Just one more question," Dr. Annan said. "When do you think was the last time you were really angry?" She'd asked it in the same tone she would normally have used to talk about Clara's last period, or whether her cold had gone away, and Clara realized abruptly that Dr. Annan wasn't asking because she cared. She was collecting symptoms, not worrying, but diagnosing. Lying was an automatic response, and Clara said, "I don't know. Really? Really angry? Because when Nicole got hit by a car, I wanted to kill that driver." Dr. Annan frowned as though this were not the answer she'd been expecting. "It's all right not to feel things, you know," she said. "You can tell me the truth." "I am," Clara said immediately, and hoped she was faking irritated well enough to pass. She was better at the positive emotions, the ones people usually wanted to hear. "My best friend got hit by a car. How could I not be upset?" She meant it rhetorically, and Dr. Annan took it that way, but she almost wished she'd gotten a real answer. Why wasn't she upset? What was wrong with her? When she got home, her parents smiled at her, and she smiled automatically back, a well-trained habit, and then wondered if perhaps, if she were normal, that smile would have been real. She went to the bank that weekend and got her heart out of her family's safe deposit box. She sat in the cold gray room, box open on the table, and watched her heart silently beat from moment to moment, seeming real and not real, a heart and a metaphor as she watched. The table was under the air conditioning vent, leaving her shivering. She had always gotten cold easily. With Dr. Anna diagnosing her whole life, she was starting to wonder if that could be a symptom, too. She'd let herself forget everything she knew about the circulatory system after bio class ended, but maybe with a heart she'd be warmer. That sounded nice. Anger and pain and fear didn't, though, and dying sounded worse. She could still see the look on her parents' face, her mother's certainty that putting her heart back in meant death as surely as if she'd thrown herself off a cliff. There were diseases that could be fatal in children that wouldn't hurt adults. If it had been one of those, she would probably be fine. If it were some degenerative disorder, though, her mother would be right. She tried to be a good friend to Nicole these last few weeks, but she hadn't quite understood what she ought to do, and she had caught a few strange looks when she failed to respond with expected sympathy. If Clara's parents died, would it matter to her? She was sure it was supposed to. Her heart felt foggy in her grip, not quite solid, like a lump of pure heat, and her skin tingled as she touched it. Pressing it to her chest didn't work, even when she unbuttoned her shirt, and finally she dug in her backpack for scissors, broke them apart, and drove one end into her chest. It hurt a little, more than a paper cut, and sharper, cleaner, colder where steel met skin. She prodded a bit at the hole and hoped her heart would fit, hefted it, and pressed it to her chest again. The heart seemed to slide from her fingers, trickling into the cut. It flowed faster and faster as she pushed, pouring out of her hands to drip down between her ribs. Then it was gone, and she felt the skin close under her fingers and beneath it, a stirring like a drumbeat caught echoing in her chest. The rhythm was slow and steady, and though it was hardly proof, it seemed like she might have longer to live than her mother had suspected. She hoped so. Dying held a jagged terror now that it hadn't when her mother first described it, and the beating in her chest sped up with the thought, her throat tightening with something that might be panic. Her hands were bloody, and she started to wipe them on her jeans, realizing just in time that she shouldn't let her parents see the stains. They would worry, and now she understood why. Looking at the blood on her hands was suddenly dizzying, brought a wave of nausea and the sudden inability to breathe. For a choked, frantic second, she thought something had gone wrong with her heart, beating too fast, her breathing going wrong. Was this what dying felt like? She wanted the blood off her hands urgently, smeared it on the silk inside the case until her skin was clean. With the blood gone, her heart rate started to fall, and she took a deep breath, until she no longer felt like she might suffocate. She waited until she had mostly stopped shaking to return the box, empty now, to the safe deposit box. When she walked out of the bank, it was pouring, and the rain hit her like a physical blow, shocking, cold. The sheer energy of it made her grin, and she took off running on impulse, splashing through puddles and laughing until she had to stop and gasp for air. When she'd stopped laughing, the cold started to seep in again, and it was baffling how quickly her emotions shifted, now that she had them. Once the rain stopped being a novelty, it just felt cold and heavy and soaking, and she was grateful for the occasional awning, shielding her for a moment. Without the distraction of running, she could feel the fear already coming back, slow, suffocating waves that the darkness only intensified. She was going to die. She might have only hours left to live. She'd never been so aware of being alive. As she walked, she turned her face up to the rain and smiled.
You've been listening to Science Fiction Shorts on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Kurt Benrud. My team of volunteer readers and I thank you for listening in. And we would love to have you join us next time. Just a quick reminder, this program is available in podcast, and it is intended for an audience that is blind or print impaired. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. As always, our number is 832-5138, and that's 919-832-5138. If you're a fan of sci-fi and have something to say, we want to hear from you.